there will be some surprise. It's understatement. I am happy to be in the position to welcome our colleague, our discourse colleague from the University from Köln, Jet Hoek. And she thinks there will be no surprise, but I'm sure there will be some surprise. So I'll just invite you to take the floor.
Thank you for the introduction. Thank you also for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here. So the point of departure for my talk today is the finding or the observation that when we process language, when we listen or read to when we read or listen to a text, we don't just passively wait to see what the next word is going to be to process that, but we actually actively engage in predicting upcoming linguistic material. So when you hear a sentence start with "let it," you know, you might actually have some expectations about the next word, the word to follow it. So you might think of be, go, snow, happen, or some kind of other verb like come or rest. And I've ranked these in terms of relative, you know, baseline frequency in these contexts. So be is more frequent, is most frequent. In this context, so this baseline frequency matters, but actually also other contexts matter. So both the direct linguistic content and sort of the broader discourse context. So for instance, given that it's like we're in December and Christmas is just around the corner, maybe you thought of snow instead of be, even though it occurs less often across the board in this specific context. So the idea that we have expectations when we process language seems to influence, from the speaker perspective, how we produce language. And this, you know, effective predictability on language production has been shown to influence has been shown to hold many or several different language levels of language. And specifically, we see that expected content is usually expressed using a reduced form. And conversely, non-expected content is often expressed using a non-reduced form, so somehow a more elaborate, bigger, larger form. So for example, at the level, sort of morphological level, we there's evidence that English be, have, or not tend to be reduced in those contexts where they are especially expected, and to get a more full-fledged pronunciation or transcription if they're more unexpected. Similarly, a similar process happens at the level of phonetics, where it's been shown that time and time are not actually homophones like they were sort of hypothesized to be. So time, as in hours, minutes, you know, the temporal meaning, tends to be realized in a more sort of shorter, more reduced phonological form than the verb time, just because it's more frequent than the verb. So because it's more expected, it tends to be more reduced. And this is an example of a study that finds a similar effect on level of syntax. So if we have an English a sentence that includes a complement clause, when this sentence expresses a more predictable content, more expected, we more often tend to use the complementizer that than when the contents of the sentence is fairly predictable. So the idea that that predictability matters for language production is not just it doesn't just come from observations about language use, but it also has its grounding in several different linguistic theories. For instance, the relatively recent uniform information density hypothesis by Levine Yeager, which states that we as humans have some kind of communication channel, and we should make use of that communication channel in the most optimal way, which according to them is a uniform distribution of information across our utterances. So to illustrate this, on the left we see a good use of the communication channel. So say that the green line is sort of like the maximum capacity of our channel, the maximum thing or maximum amount of information we can process at each individual time point. Then this is a really good use of the channel because it's a relatively uniform distribution. We don't exceed the amount of information we can convey to the other person at once, and we don't have any words that are there redundantly. So if we suppose that all these bars are words, on the right, we see a very bad use of the channel, or a pretty bad use of the channel, because we see one word that sort of is very surprising, and it exceeds sort of the amount of information we can comfortably process. But we also see at least two words that present sort of really deep information troughs. So these words are essentially redundant, and they are linguistic material that is there, but doesn't add new information. So this is, in this model, actually these information troughs are the redundant expected content that should probably, in an optimal world, not be produced at all. And these notions are, this is also very similar to basically Grice's quantity maxim, Horn's QNR principles. And it can also be found a similar idea in the like relevance theoretic concepts of effort versus effect, where speakers don't want to put a lot of effort into linguistic material that doesn't yield a big effect. And so basically, these information troughs in UID, and conversely, hearers don't want to put a lot of effort into interpreting something that might have a bad, a minimal effect. So this would be basically the information peaks in UID. At the level of discourse, so at the discourse level, we also know, or there are indications that language users also generate expectations about linguistic content. For instance, people have expectations about which coherence relations are going to be mentioned next. So in the context of specific verbs, we might predict that there's going to be an explanation relation, or there's going to be a contrast. We also have expectations about discourse structure. So if we hear, for instance, English on the one hand, we expect there to be some kind of contrastive element in the preceding discourse that sort of contrasts with the proposition headed by on the one hand. And we make predictions about the content of discourse segments. So if we hear something like, John was craving a savory snack, so he went to the fridge and took out a slice of pizza, then that is perfectly fine. It's very expected. But if we have something like, although John was craving a savory snack, he went to the fridge and took out a slice of pizza, the pizza is very surprising, because we use this although in combination with the information in the first discourse segment in this relation. So although he was craving a savory snack. And this makes the pizza grabbing very surprising. So we use this information from the connective to predict something about the content of the discourse segments. So we have all these expectations about upcoming discourse, discourse level features. So actually a question then is, if we can see a similar process of sort of reduction in expected contexts that we see at other levels of language. So this is a question I'm going to be addressing today. And specifically, I'm going to talk about coherence relations, where we can explicitly mark a coherence relation, but also leave the coherence relation underspecified or implicit. And I'm going to talk about referring expressions in English, so where we have the choice of referring to a previously introduced antecedent using a pronoun or a more elaborate description, for instance, a full noun phrase. So first I'm going to tell you something about the marking of coherence relations. So as you probably well know, coherence relations connect discourse segments in a text, and these relations can but need not be explicitly marked. So this is an example where the relation is explicitly marked. So we've spent 25,000 pounds on our twins' first Christmas, even though they won't remember it. We have an even though is very explicitly marking this type of concession between the two discourse segments. And it doesn't seem very likely that there's any additional inference compared to what the connective is explicitly signaling. On the other hand, like on the other side of the spectrum, we can have an implicit relation. So for example, the reality is that if you have 10 New Year's resolutions, you really have zero. Pinpoint one goal and throw all your energy behind it. So basically, we can add a so, for example. So it's basically a result. So if you have, if you have this given, then this is going to be my advice to you, and it's sort of a result, a conclusion, but we don't have an explicit marker for this. And there's some kind of intermediate form, such as in this relation. So switching to a healthier diet can be incredibly tricky when we are surrounded by cheap junk food. So the connective that's there when sort of explicitly signals something temporal, so at the same time, but we get also this, I at least get this sort of causal inference that, you know, because we are surrounded by cheap junk food, it's actually pretty hard to switch to a healthier diet. So in this case, we could call this an underspecified coherence relation because we do have an explicit, some kind of explicit signal, but we get an additional inference on top of it. So it's not fully explicitly marked like this first example. And intuitively, it just doesn't seem to be the case that all types of relations can equally easily be left implicit or underspecified. So if you look at the explicit example from the previous slide, and we remove the even though, it barely makes any sense. So if we've spent 25,000 pounds on our twins' first Christmas, they won't remember it. I mean, it's just not as easy, not as coherent, not as nice as the explicit version was. And the intuition that, you know, some types of coherence relations are more easily left implicit than others is very much supported by analyses on discourse-annotated corpora, where we just see differences between different types of coherence relations in how often these receive a connective. So if we explore the question of maybe predictability matters somehow for the implicit versus explicit marking of coherence relations, we do automatically get a different question or a related question, which is the question of which coherence relations people expect. And there's a few hypotheses that seem to speak to this. So there's the continuity hypothesis by Murray in 97. So this hypothesis states that readers have a certain bias toward interpreting sentences in a narrative as following each other in a continuous manner. And what he calls continuous is basically temporally forward relations, so relations that sort of like follow the iconic order of events in the real world. Causal relations are continuous in his definition, also additive relations that don't involve some kind of contrast. There's a second hypothesis that seems to talk about the types of coherence relations that people expect. So this is the causality by default hypothesis by Sundler's 2005. And this hypothesis says that because readers aim at building the most informative representation, they start out assuming the relation between two consecutive sentences is a causal relation. So this hypothesis also, much like the continuity hypothesis, says that people expect causal relations. And there's a paper by Osser and Denberg, 2012, that uses annotated data from the Penn Discourse Tree Bank in English, and they show that, you know, indeed the types of relations that these two hypotheses predict to be often implicit are indeed often left unmarked, more so than other types of relations. However, they find additional differences that cannot be accounted for using these two hypotheses. For instance, they find the conditional, you know, these two hypotheses say nothing about the implicitness of conditional relations, for instance, because it's not clear if these are causal, if these are continuous, etc. So, like, it doesn't seem like these two hypotheses alone can sort of give us the full predictions that we need. So, in a 2017 paper, we departed from the hypothesis that somehow people expect simple coherent solutions. So, and this is based on findings by an earlier paper, Trexler and colleagues, where they say that readers try to establish the simplest possible relation. So then we asked, okay, can we sort of predict the implicit versus explicit marking of coherence relations using the notion of cognitive complexity? So the hypothesis would be simple relations are expected, so these would be usually uttered using a reduced form, so under-specified or implicit coherence relation, and complex relations would be not expected, so it would get a more explicit marking. This again gives us an additional question, which is to say that what is cognitively complex? However, because this is sort of like a cognitive hypothesis, we do expect that this would hold cross-linguistically, and that's something we took into account for our study as well. First of all, we tried to establish the cognitive complexity of coherence relations using four sources of evidence. So first, logic. So some coherence relations are logically less complex than others. So for example, coherence relations involving some form of contrast are logically more elaborate than relations that don't involve contrast. We also looked at evidence from language processing, where we took sort of faster processing times and to be an indication of sort of relative simplicity to as compared to relations that often people spend more time processing. We looked at language acquisition data, so which types of relations are acquired earlier, if it's acquired early in sort of like the acquisition trajectory, then we suppose these to be simple, and later acquired coherence relations to be more difficult. And finally, we also took into account mental space theory, which is a bit beyond the scope of the current talk. But basically, we sort of this is how we established the cognitive complexity of coherence relations, and then we tested this hypothesis. So we did so using a parallel corpus study where we looked at data from the Europol direct corpus, where we know which language was the original language that everything was uttered in, and then we know that all the other ones are translations of other languages. And we departed from approximately 2,000 English coherence relations that were explicitly marked. And we annotated all these relations using the cognitive approach to coherence relations, which you may or may not be familiar with, but I'll give some specifics in the results. So for now, it doesn't really matter. And we looked at translations from these English coherence relations into German, Dutch, French, and Spanish. And in this approach, we sort of take implicitation, so the removal of explicitness in translation as an indicator for a relation's potential to be implicit. So if so intuitively, if we have a because relation and we remove the because, you know, to in translation, this will be perfectly acceptable. So people will only do this. So the idea is that translators do this mostly if it doesn't result in a uninterpretable or very a relation that has a very changed meaning compared to the source text. But if we have a relation that is hard to convey implicitly, translators will be less likely to do so. So if we think back of the even though example, if we remove the even though, it just becomes very different. So the more often a type of relation is becomes implicit in translation, we took to be an indication of how easily these can be implicit, in just monolingual language. And what we do find is that, like we hypothesized overall, simple relations tend to be more often implicitated in translation than complex coherence relations. And this held across all four language pairs. So this was sort of the cross-linguistic hypothesis that we had. And specifically, we found that basic order relations, so relations that follow the iconic order of events in the real world, were more often implicitated than non-basic order relations, so relations where the order is reversed. We also found that speech-act relations were more often implicitated than other types of relations. So speech-act relations being something like, could you open the window? It's really hot in here, where you have a speech act, and then, for instance, a motivation for the speech act. And then we found sort of an interaction effect between what in CCR is called polarity and basic operation. And specifically, we found that all conditionals, both involving contrast and those not involving contrast, were least often implicitated in translation. So these are least often implicit. A little bit more often implicit would be negative causal relations, which is basically the same as concessions. So very similar to the even though relation on the previous slide. And then we didn't really find a difference between positive additive, positive causal, and negative additive relations. So these would be, for instance, because or so relations, relations marked by it or by and or also, and relations marked by but, where we don't have somehow this, so just a contrastive relation would be negative additive. So this study sort of suggested that expected relations are more often implicit or underspecified than relations that are not expected, and this is in line with the Esser and Denberg results from 2012. So this, together these studies sort of seem to show that, or seem to suggest, that predictability also influences language production at the discourse level. But this is just, these are two studies, and we might actually need a lot more evidence for this. But for now, this seems to be the case. Coherence relations are not the only types of discourse level phenomena that we have or use. So more recently, I've also looked at choice of referring expression and asked if predictability matters for this question, for this discourse level phenomenon. So if we have a sentence like, yesterday John ran into Russell, this might be continued with a number of different expressions, but we can explicitly refer back to John using John. We can say Russell to refer back to Russell. We can also say he, which is then either refers back to John or Russell. And it seems in general that this pronoun use at least in English, is influenced by topichood and subjecthood. This is something that basically everyone finds to be an important factor. But then sort of evidence differs in whether predictability also matters for this discourse level phenomenon. So there's some studies that find that yes, more predictable reference are more often referred back to using a pronoun. But then there's other studies that don't find this effect at all. And one observation is that results appear to differ between studies using, depending on the types of experimental items these experiments use. So experiments that have used verbs of transfer, where we give something to someone or hand something to someone, these do find effects of predictability. But implicit causality verbs, such as admire or fire someone, experiments using these types of verbs tend to not find an effect of predictability. And so in the remainder of my talk, I'm going to talk about two ways in which I've tried to sort of reconcile the conflicting findings. So we first addressed the potential confound in the transfer verb studies, which I can already tell you doesn't seem to be an actual confound. And then we looked at a new context type to see if maybe it's really the very local context that matters for these types of findings, which could also predict conflicting findings in the literature. So one thing, and this is joint work with Hanna Rode at the University of Edinburgh. So one thing we notice is that in the verbs of transfer experiments that look into the effect of predictability on pronoun production, pronoun use, there does seem to be a potential confound in the experiments that use verbs of transfer, which is the obligatory versus optional status of competitor reference. And specifically, they seem to create sort of non-minimal pairs in manipulating thematic rule. So thematic rule manipulation is something that happens a lot in this body of experiments, because that seems to really matter for predictability. So we have, and then they change around, they switch around the grammatical rule and the thematic rule. And in doing so, they sort of create non-minimal pairs. So we have Kyle gave a book to Sue, which is a ditransitive verb, and we have two human reference that can both be pronominalized using a pronoun. But we, in this case, we have an obligatory non-subject. In the other condition, we're sort of that has reversed thematic roles, we see that Kyle received a book from Sue, but Sue is actually optional, so this is an adjunct. And maybe, we thought, so what these studies find is that in this case, Kyle is pronominalized more often than here, which they attribute to the more predictable nature of this source role. But we thought, okay, maybe it's not about the grammatical role. Maybe it is really that in these ditransitive constructions, when there's an obligatory competitor to the subject, or syntactically obligatory competitor to the subject, maybe that's just a better competitor, in terms of topicality, because they're more integral to the event that happens than when they're an adjunct, for instance. So we thought, okay, maybe optional versus obligatory competitor reference might influence actually the pronominalization rate of other reference. So this is what we tested. And we ran a story continuation experiment where we present participants with a prompt and then we ask them to write some kind of continuation that seems logical to them. And in this experiment, we had three conditions. So we had a baseline condition where we just have one referent, Patrick. Patrick is boring. And then we have two conditions where you have two referents, but then one is sort of syntactically optional. Patrick is boring to Emily. And in the other case, the other condition, we have two referents, but the non-subject is an obligatory argument of the verb. So Patrick bores Emily. And we pre-tested these items or these prompts where we asked other participants how interchangeable the meanings were, and overall these were rated as pretty interchangeable. And we picked the best, most interchangeable ones and created 18 items out of for our experiment. We then ran the first, we first ran a batch, we conducted this experiment using 65 participants, all native speakers of English, and we did find a small effect, but we wanted to replicate this. So in total, we did three iterations of this experiment. So the first one, we included all three conditions. Second one, we dropped the baseline condition because we felt we would get a little bit more power using just two conditions. So we repeated this experiment, but then results were different. And then we ran it again in its original form. So that's how we ended up with 180 participants for the last two conditions, and 130 participants for the last two conditions. And I'm actually going to show results using both subsets. So when we got continuations from all our participants, we coded those continuations. So we decided who they wrote the continuation about. So for instance, did they write about Patrick or Emily or someone else or something else? In which case we did not consider this for our analysis. And then if they do talk about either Patrick or Emily, we coded what form of referring expression was used. So did they use a pronoun or a full NP? This was most of the data. So I'm going to show you results now for all three conditions. And on the left, we see the re-mention rate. And we take this to be a measure for the predictability of the reference. So here we have the, I can actually do this. So this is the one ref condition, where we just have Patrick, basically. And all of these refer just to the subject because we want to see what the effect of the status of the second, the presence or status of the second referent is on the pronomization or remention rate of the subject. So in this condition, Patrick was the only one, and we see that he is referred or like re-mentioned almost 100% of the time. And it doesn't seem to matter whether we have an obligatory or an optional competitor for how often people want to talk about the subject of the previous sentence. So how often people want to talk about Patrick. It doesn't matter if Emily is an adjunct or an object or direct object. So this is not different, but this is significantly different, which Patrick is re-mentioned more often if he's the only one in the sentence or in the discourse context. Crucially though, when we look at the pronominalization rate, we actually don't find, so these little stars are the means, and we don't find a significant difference between the pronominalization rates of these referents, even though we do find that here Patrick is a lot more predictable, the subject. So, even though we do find a significant difference in predictability between these conditions, this one and these two, we don't find this here at all. So in terms of pronominalization rate, Patrick becomes he to the same extent in all three conditions. So this is not really, not at all an effect of predictability on pronormalization rates. There might, because we are looking at the subject, we thought maybe there's some sort of ceiling effect, because subjects are referred back to using pronouns a lot anyway. And we also thought, okay, we use verbs that are all sort of similar, but they're not the same. And this is why we ran a by-item analysis. So we have on the x-axis here, we have the pronominalization, we have the re-mention rate. So how often is the referent being re-mentioned? And here is the pronominalization rate. So how often does the referent become a pronoun? And we plotted for each individual item this rate for subjects and non-subjects. And for subjects, we find no effect. But actually for non-subjects, so the non-predictable referent in this case, we did find a positive correlation between re-mention rate and predictability. So that when your non-subjects, when they are less predictable, so here they are pronominalized less often than when they are more predictable. But this only, we found this result only in a by-item analysis for each specific verb and only on the non-predictable referent, so where we don't have a ceiling effect, but maybe, so where we don't have the ceiling effect of being pronominalized almost 100% of the time. And so what we take away from this experiment is that the optional versus obligatory status of competitor reference doesn't really seem to matter, doesn't really seem to matter, and therefore doesn't really seem to be an explanation for conflicting results in the literature. We did find an effect of predictability, but only if we looked at these items if we looked at our experimental items on an item by item basis, and even then the effect, it's not huge. This is some evidence that predictability matters, but I don't find it particularly convincing. Or we don't find it very convincing, but it's an effect nonetheless. Because we're still left with this problem where we don't really find clear effects of predictability on pronominalization rates, others do. We tried to come up with a new context type where we could test the same thing. And what is similar, why people have used verbs of transfer and verbs of implicit causality, is that the subject is often not the most predictable referent. So you can tease apart effects of subjecthood or topichood and effects of predictability. And for most contexts, these actually coincide, so the subject is re-mentioned most often and it is the subject. So we tried to come up with a context type where we didn't have these two factors coinciding. And we came up with this context that we call the benefactive context. So we had things like Adam called Diana for Russell. And intuitively, we expected that people would want to talk about this third referent, this Russell person, this benefactive person, because it's just not really clear why he would be mentioned otherwise. So he seems especially relevant or salient for the discourse. So in all of these conditions, in all of our items, there were two referents that were competing in terms of gender. But this was matched across all items. So either we had the subject and the benefactive the same, like in this example, or we had Diana calling Adam for Russell, or Adam calling Russell for Diana. But this was counterbalanced. The original experiment has two conditions where we also have a pronoun prompt, but that's for a different question, so I won't be talking about those data today. But we ran this experiment using on 83 native speakers of English, and so we have 15 items where we just have the same design as in the previous experiment, where people are free to write whatever they want and free to re-mention whoever they want to, and they can also refer to this person in whichever way they prefer. Again, we coded continuations for who the continuation is about, so who they refer to next, and what form of referring expression is used. And I should say that this is joint work with also Hannah Rode, but also Andy Kaler at UCSD. So again, I've plotted the re-mention rate on the left and the pronominalization rate on the right. And here we have the pairs of reference that were in gender competition. So here we have the object, the first and the second referent, first and third, and second and third. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, all re-mentions in subject position. Yeah. So subject position of the continuation. Yep. So this is all of the re-mentions, and then this is how. This is basically a subset of these re-mentions, like how often are they re-mentioned using a pronoun. So it doesn't really seem to matter who, I'm not really gonna talk about the gender competition here, but what is important to note about these graphs is that these pink bars, they are the benefactives. So this is the benefactive, the third person, and we, like we predicted, this is the person they refer back to most often, participants. So this referent is re-mentioned more often than the other two referents. And the re-mention rate of the subject and the second person, they don't significantly differ. So third person is mentioned more often than the first and second person, but there's no difference between first and second person. In terms of pronominalization rate, however, we see a different difference. So we see that the subject, these gray bars, they're being re-mentioned, they're being pronominalized a lot, more so than the other two. But here, we see the pronominalization rates of the second and third referent are matched. Even though they significantly differed in terms of their predictability. So again, we don't see an effect of predictability on pronominalization rate, not in this way. And we couldn't do a by-item analysis because we don't have enough data for this. But yeah, so these overall means just don't line up with an account that where predictability matters for choice of referring expression. So I'm going to conclude this talk by saying that evidence for predictability influencing language production at the discourse level is mixed. It does seem to be the case that expected coherence relations are more often expressed using a reduced form, so implicitly or underspecified, than relations that are not expected. However, there's just no clear effect of predictability on choice of referring expression. We did find this one, a small effect in the by-item analysis we did on the first experiment, but it's not big. So if it's there, it's just not huge. And definitely a lot smaller than this subjecthood or topichood factor. But we can ask why we get these mixed results. So that, both within the
choice, like referring expression experiments, not just ours but also others, and between the coherence relations on the one hand and the choice of referring expressions on the other hand. So one big difference between this very first study I talked about coherence relations, and these experimental studies on choice referring expressions is that they use very different methodologies. And one is corpus-based, one is experimental. And maybe this matters somehow. Maybe there's a difference in how important the effect of predictability on language production is in regular, like natural language use versus language use in experiments. But maybe this is not, like, this doesn't seem to be the best explanation to me. I think what's maybe more likely is that there's a difference between coherence relations and referring expressions, which there just is. When we talk about choice of referring expressions, we do also have this really clear structural factor, the subjecthood or topichood factor that really unambiguously seems to influence pronominalization rates. And we just don't, like, I don't think there's a similar operation or a similar process that, you know, for coherence relations. So maybe it has something to do with that. It might also be different. So one difference between this first study I talked about and the second two is that it does seem to be a little different in terms of the type of predictability we considered. So in this very first experiment on coherence relations, we really do talk about baseline expectancies, baseline frequencies, because cognitive complexity is just something that, you know, so it didn't differ from context to context, but it was taken as a general variable regardless of the specific instance, specific local context. In the experiments, this just seems to be slightly different. So we really measured predictability within this specific context and not just in general. So maybe this is more important than the fact that, you know, the corpus-based versus experimental methodology. I'm very interested to learn if there are maybe also individual differences between speakers. We know that people produce, process language in different ways. And this whole idea that using a reduced form for a more expected meaning is somehow, the idea behind it is that it's somehow economical. Also for the speaker, because they don't have to produce it, but also for the hearer, because they don't, you know, it's just a better, cleaner input. But then, you know, I do wonder if it's not, you know, because you have the trouble of pronouncing this extra word, for instance, or writing it down, but on the other hand, you do have to calculate how predictable this is going to be for the hearer, and then you have to sort of like come back to yourself and then either produce it or not produce it. And this choice of, you know, either reducing or non-reducing your linguistic form also seems effortful. And so maybe people don't do this to the same extent, or they don't do this to the same extent all the time, or people differ in how well they are at doing this. So I think this could be a very interesting question for future research. And this really also pertains to these local contexts and not just to across-the-board frequencies, I think. This, by item analysis, does suggest that there might be differences between verbs, that, you know, one type of verb maybe behaves slightly differently than other types of verbs, or even specific verbs within a class we've somehow created. But that also really yields a question of how fine-grained our predictions are. So are these really ad hoc things we calculate all the time? Or are these, you know, baseline frequencies that we know from our experience, like basically all the knowledge we've accumulated over a lifetime? Maybe those are more important. And if it's really also baseline frequencies, We can also ask how fine-grained this is. So do we store our knowledge for each individual word, like verb or word we know, or do we also somehow create classes? But these are questions I don't really have answers to right now. And things I'm definitely looking forward to exploring in future research, and hopefully others will as well. But for now, thank you for listening.
Thank you for a very nice and interesting talk. I would like to ask how the items were built. How long was the context before this sentence? And I'm asking about that because I would like to know whether these reference, like this name, Patrick, Emily, and so on, whether they were mentioned in the previous context or not. So how far they were deducible from the previous context, or whether they are comparable, whether they are completely new.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. As a sort of common for this paradigm, these problems are presented to participants without any context. And this works really well for these items where we have two reference. So people have tested this actually to see if maybe a participant's behavior changes if you add a lot of context, if you get to sort of intimately know Patrick and you know all about Emily and you know what they look like, etc. But that doesn't really seem to be the case. So here it doesn't really seem to matter if we get context or not. So we didn't add context. Here, however, so I did mention that we had this other condition that doesn't speak to the question I was talking about today, but it does sort of, it was relevant for other, a different research question. We have good reason to believe that here, where we also didn't include any context, either, you know, direct linguistic context or, you know, broader knowledge about Adam, Diana, whoever. So we do have good reason to believe that here, people don't like this so much. So we get, specifically, it's because this, you know, where we measure how people interpret a pronoun that they're presented with, instead of that they, you know, that they don't produce, but that is used by someone else. These results differ drastically from other experiments. And so we have actually repeated this experiment with, because, so there were two possible explanations for this. So first of all, maybe it's the specific construction, in which case the construction matters, or it's the fact that there's three reference now, which might be, you know, for some reason dispreferred or difficult or something. So we did a follow-up experiment that was the easiest one. So we got rid of the second referent and sort of like, so we, like Adam called the hospital for Russell. So where we didn't have a person with some kind of name that they didn't, you know about, but something more concrete, not a person. And all of a sudden results fall back in line with, you know, what we know from previous studies, previous literature, other experiments. So it really does seem to matter that all of a sudden people get these three reference in a very short sentence that they have no context for, that they don't know about. And we're now thinking that maybe it's just really hard to visualize or sort of conceptualize these prompts because there's a lot of new information. And so we are planning an experiment basically where we do have three reference, but then we have like the doctor calling the nurse for the patient, where we just have more concrete knowledge, so more context inside of, you know, these reference where we, you know, to see if, you know, how those results compare to these results. So, yeah.
Thank you so much. Well, I feel that this sentence could be really difficult to understand because you don't have the information structure there. And mm-hmm. I can imagine that the readers or the recipients, that they simply don't understand it, or they don't understand it in the same way, and therefore they don't know how to go on then.
Yes. Yeah. So I think, yeah. So that we also think that it has to do something with information structure or with, you know, a hard time conceptualizing these things, because honestly, so people write these continuations while the prompt stays on their screen. So it's not that they have to remember three names. So the task doesn't become harder. Like, what they have to do isn't all of a sudden more difficult. But it really seems to be somehow, you know, with processing these prompts, has to do something with that. And so if you have suggestions for the reason why they don't, why people don't really add more context before this, because you get a lot of factors interfering with this. So like bridging inferences, topicality things, things that might actually change some of the things we're trying to manipulate. So yeah, that's why.
Thank you.
Anyway, I have some different questions, but when we are speaking about this particular construction or structure, I have a problem with it. Does it mean actually that Adam called Diana in order to get Russell, right? Because if you tell that people didn't like this, so it really might be because the for preposition is really heavy with its meaning, or am I not wrong? Tell me, did you mean this one?
So we came up with this. So we came up with this benefactive construction where we have something like someone doing something. Something to someone for someone. On behalf of someone. There's not that many things you can do to another person for someone else. It's pretty limited. After we ran the experiment, we also saw that calling is sort of has like, or this sentence at least has two meanings. So you can have, you can call Diana to reach Russell, or you can call Diana because Russell asked you to, for example. And we talked about this with some, semantic role people, and they couldn't really tell us what the difference was between those, between the role of Russell and either, because they do seem kind of themey or benefactive-y, or...
It might confuse the people who are...
So at the time...
But they are native speakers, so they should know the construction, right? So.
We decided that it didn't matter so much because probably in terms of thematic roles, which that is a manipulation, the meanings don't really differ. But actually later we thought that maybe it does really matter that it's an ambiguous sentence, so maybe that adds to the complexity. But obviously not every item was like this. So even if we minimally changed this, so we had like communication verbs seemed nice for this construction, but if you email someone for someone, It's. I mean, unless you're trying to reach like your 110-year-old someone, and then maybe they don't have email themselves, so you email your mother for your grandmother or something. But that just seems that alternative reading seems very unavailable for most of the other prompts we used.
And actually, my like bigger or more general remark is that what I value from your work and maybe your colleagues back in Utrecht, that you do a lot of this experimentation with production, because we would actually end up with corpus data, and when I work with pronominalization and predictions, then Ural Parle wouldn't help me much, because I expect that text, which includes some law, are explicitly nominal, not really pronominal, because you would like to avoid all this, what happens when you pronominalize too much. So production experiments are quite new for, I think it's, they're new for us, and it's nice to have a little more from that, for more insight on how it's done.
Yeah, so I've started looking into seeing, you know, sort of the similar, you know, if I could use this data for analyzing coherence relations and the explicit marking of those, so to do the similar analysis, but for coherence relations. But this is sort of complicated by the fact that we put a period here, like a full stop. So people don't really tend to use a lot of connectives. Some people do, where they will just add like because or something, but I don't think there's going to be enough data. But yeah, production data for coherence relations might actually be, yeah, that's something else. Pretty valuable.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. one, they concern this discussion part of your slides. You suggested that there may be a difference between speakers, and I think this is really true because it depends on the, I don't know, the experience or I don't want to say education, but maybe too, on the speakers, how they interpret or what they prefer, how, especially how they interpret the implicit relations, because if they are more experienced in reading, they probably will be more I don't know, inclined to give some kind of interpretation. If not, they need some explicit markers.
Yeah.
The second point is, again, from your discussion, you said that there may be a difference between the verbs. I would say between the events which the verb identifies.
Yeah.
So, for instance, with this... if you have a pronoun prompt, then it really depends what kind of event is to be referred to in the second question, because some kind of event just indicates which of these NPs are he and which cannot be. So I think this is a very important
if I could just, so all of these verbs, especially in sort of like verbs of transfer or like implicit causality verbs, they are groups of verbs, so you know they're hypothesized to be sort of similar, even though, you know, in terms of verb types, those are supposed to be different. But you know, and so I used verbs mostly because obviously I do mean events, but like a very fine grain, it matters if you're calling or emailing or
And my third question concerns what you have mentioned at the very beginning on the predictability. You referred to Murray and to Sanders for the preference of temporal relations and the causality by default. How they judge this? I mean, did they... what were the indications for them to have this kind of suggestion?
So, the continuity hypothesis is mostly based on experimental data. So he has a few experiments in this paper, and then this is sort of the conclusion slash hypothesis. The causality by default hypothesis is really, in this paper, there's no, I think, no new data, but it really discusses sort of the, I think, so what's called, or what Tetzlanders calls the paradox of causal complexity. So logically, causal relations are more complex than like simple addition. Also, you know, acquisition research shows that children like start producing and understanding additive relations earlier than causal relations. However, for if you look at adults, causal relations are processed faster, they're read faster, they are recalled better. So it just seems that somehow, even though the logical you know, in terms of logic and in terms of acquisition trajectory, causal relations are difficult. Once you have them, we seem to really like them, and then they become really, really easy for us. So this is sort of what this hypothesis is based on. And currently, I think there's a paper forthcoming where it's sort of not causality by default, but because that's definitely too strong, but he calls it a causal preference, because we do really like to see causality, and this not just in linguistic behavior or language processing, but also, you know, if we in you know, the way we just interpret events or something in the real world. So this seems to be a more general cognitive preference.
And just a minor remark, if you speak about the subjecthood and topicality, it comes almost to the same if you take English, the language study, but it need not come to the same result if you have different type of language.
Yes.
It is interesting to see how this works, which one is the preferred one.
Yes, and that's why I did talk about subjecthood slash topichood for English, because we don't really know. But yes, I think there's some research on languages where they, you know, where this is more distinct. And so this is very interesting to see. And maybe this doesn't, these are cross-linguistic differences as well. And, you know, does the subjecthood matter, or topicality? Or, this is, I don't speak a language where these are very different, so,
Okay.
Are there any further?
Yes.
You mentioned that it depends on the speaker, that it varies, and you also did some cross-lingual experiments with the Euro-Paro dialect, and if I'm not mistaken, I think it depends also on the translator. So I think the translator is not annotated there, who was the translator, and if different translators have different ratio of implicitation, which was not in the original. Yeah. So have you done any research on this, or plans, or is there any related work? I mean, the question is whether it depends on the target language or rather on the translator.
Yeah, so the nice and at the same time bad thing about using the Europol corpus is that we don't know who translates all these things. But what we do know that, so basically just a team signs off on the translation. Because we took data from spanning 8 years or something, so from pretty big languages, all of them. So we know that multiple translators worked on, you know, all this entire data set, and then these are checked, etc. So we don't know exactly who translated what, but we do know that it was not a single person translating everything from English into German. So we don't really think there's an annotator bias. In our data, we did find that there was overall much less implicitation into Spanish, and no difference between the other languages. So the question is if this is really a cross-linguistic difference between English and Spanish, or if it's a translator policy. And I'm inclined to think that it's the latter. But this would be obviously a very interesting question to explore further. So we don't think we have a really clear translator bias in terms of individual translators, but there might be difference of translation policies. But there's no implicit, translation policies might differ between being very staying true to the source text or being explicit as possible, but they don't seem to be really talking about the things that we are looking at. So they don't tell translators if it's a because you can leave it out, but if it's a but you should definitely keep it in. So these, you know, it doesn't happen on that level. So we don't think there was much influence of this.
Thank you.
I like this question because I have some fresh experience with a parallel Czech English course, and
I think this is a big issue to say something about the target language, because you never know whether it's a just mimicry of the source language or whether it's independent sentence, so to say. So I think this is always a big issue.
Yeah, and I think maybe So we use data only from the very early years of the Europol corpus, because we, like, then there was really one-to-one translation from each language into the other languages. But then, you know, in 2003, when a lot of new countries were added, like, there were too many language pairs, and everything is like, they started using pivot languages. And I think, you know, for English Czech, this wouldn't really be a problem, probably. But yeah, so it's really hard to guarantee that translations are direct translations, whereas before, you know, we definitely, you know, everyone translated from English into, like, if it was said in English, it would be translated into German, and then from English into French, English into Spanish. But now, everything's first translated into English and German, and then it, you know, might actually be an indirect translation as well, which is also very interesting what that adds, but it's hard to, I don't think you can track that either, so. But yeah, but if you deal with English, that's maybe not such a problem, because, you know, it's one of these pivot languages.
So if there are not any further questions, so I would like to thank you again for coming here, for
thank you very much.
Giving this talk, and I would like to thank all participants for coming in this pre-Christmas time. I would like to wish those whom we will not meet at our Christmas meeting next week all the best, and let us meet again in January. You know that we have two meetings in January, one the first Monday, which is a kind of student workshop, and then on the 20th of January. So we still have two meetings before the end of this winter term. So thank you for coming, thank you for your talk, and see you.
Thanks.